Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, unlocking the brain's secrets. I'm really fascinated by how music affects us, not just emotionally, but cognitively too. It's like, how can organized sound have such a profound impact on our brains?
I'm with you there. I've always been curious about the connection between music and the brain. Like, why do certain melodies stick with us for years, while others fade away almost instantly? It's amazing to think about the complex processes happening behind the scenes.
Exactly. And that's what we're diving into today, the psychology of music. It's this interdisciplinary field pulling from psychology, neuroscience, even musicology, to understand how we perceive, create, and respond to music.
It's a huge field, too. I mean, think about it. Everything from how we perceive pitch and rhythm to how music can be used therapeutically.
It is vast, and its history is equally fascinating. You know, the study of news and sound goes way back, like, to Pythagoras in the 6th century BC. He was exploring the mathematical ratios of string lengths and how they relate to what we perceive as harmonious.
Oh, right, the whole octave thing. And then, of course, there's Aristoxenus, who argued that music is all about human perception and memory. He was kind of a rebel going against the dominant Pythagorean view.
Totally. And that debate about the objective versus subjective nature of music continues even today. But with modern tools like fMRI and EEG, we can actually see what's happening in the brain when we listen to music. It's pretty mind-blowing.
It's like unlocking a secret code. So where do we even begin with such a complex topic? Maybe with the basics of how the brain processes melody and rhythm?
Sounds good to me. We can talk about how different parts of the brain are involved and how those processes relate to other cognitive functions like language.
And we definitely need to talk about neurotransmitters, right? Dopamine, serotonin, they all seem to play a role in how we experience the emotional impact of music.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's the therapeutic applications. Music therapy is becoming increasingly important in treating a variety of conditions from stroke to dementia.
It's incredible how music can be used to help people recover or cope with illness. It's like this universal language that can tap into parts of the brain that other therapies can't reach.
I know, right? It's really powerful stuff. So let's start with the basics of sound perception. How do those vibrations in the air actually translate into the experience of music in our brains?
Well, it starts with the ear, of course. The sound waves travel through the ear canal and vibrate the eardrum, which then sets off a chain reaction in the middle ear, eventually reaching the cochlea in the inner ear. Inside the cochlea is this amazing structure called the basilar membrane.
Right, and the basilar membrane is tonotopically organized, meaning different parts of it respond to different frequencies. So high-pitched sounds activate one area, low-pitched sounds another.
Exactly. And those vibrations on the basilar membrane trigger hair cells to release neurotransmitters, which then send electrical signals along the auditory nerve to the brainstem. And from there, the signal travels up to the auditory cortex, where the real magic happens.
So it seems like this journey of sound from the ear to the brain is already pretty complex. But then once it reaches the auditory cortex, things get even more intricate, right? I mean, how does the brain differentiate between, say, a melody and just a random sequence of notes?
That's a great question. It seems like the brain is doing multiple things at once. It's processing the individual pitches, but it's also analyzing the relationships between those pitches, looking for patterns and structure. And this is where things like rhythm, harmony, and tonality come into play.
So are there specific areas in the auditory cortex dedicated to processing these different musical elements, like a rhythm center or a harmony center?
Well, it's not quite that simple. While some areas might be more specialized for certain aspects of music, it seems like there's a lot of overlap and interaction between different regions. And importantly, the brain isn't just passively processing the music. It's also actively predicting what's going to come next based on its prior knowledge and experience with music.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's like the brain is constantly building expectations and then either confirming or revising those expectations as the music unfolds.
Exactly. And that process of prediction and anticipation seems to be a key part of what makes music so engaging and emotionally powerful. When the music violates our expectations in a surprising but pleasing way, it can trigger a release of dopamine, which is associated with pleasure and reward.
So we've established that the brain's processing of music is incredibly intricate, involving everything from basic sound perception to complex emotional responses. But let's delve into the nitty-gritty the role of neurotransmitters in this whole musical experience. What's really going on at the chemical level?
Well, it's like a complex symphony of chemical messengers, right? Neurotransmitters are these signaling molecules that neurons use to communicate with each other, and they're absolutely essential for how we experience music.
Right, and we know certain neurotransmitters are linked to pleasure and reward. Dopamine, for instance, seems to be a key player in that rush of enjoyment we get from music.
Exactly. Dopamine is released when we experience something pleasurable, like listening to a favorite song, and that reinforces the behavior, making us want to listen again. It's the same system involved in other rewarding experiences, like eating or, well, other things.
Yeah, and it's not just dopamine. Serotonin seems to be involved in mood regulation, so it likely plays a role in how music affects our emotional state. And, you know, there are other neurochemicals like endorphins, which are linked to pain relief and feelings of euphoria. They might explain why music can be so comforting or even transcendent.
That's fascinating. So it's not just one neurotransmitter, but this whole cocktail of chemicals working together to create the musical experience. It makes you wonder how different types of music might affect these neurotransmitter systems differently.
That's a great point. Like, does listening to upbeat, energetic music trigger a different dopamine response than listening to something mellow and calming? And what about different musical genres? Does heavy metal trigger a different neurochemical cascade than classical music?
I'd imagine so. And, you know, individual differences probably play a role too. Someone with a higher baseline level of dopamine might experience music differently than someone with a lower level. It's all so complex.
It really is. And then there's the question of how music can be used therapeutically. If we understand how music affects these neurotransmitter systems, we can potentially use it to treat various neurological and psychological conditions, right?
Absolutely. Music therapy is showing promise in treating conditions like Parkinson's disease, stroke, and even depression and anxiety. By stimulating specific neural pathways with music, we might be able to help people recover lost function or manage their symptoms.
It's like using music as medicine almost. And, you know, it's not just about treating illness. Music can also be used to enhance cognitive function, like memory and attention. There's evidence that musical training can actually change the structure and function of the brain.
That's incredible. It really speaks to the power of music to shape our brains and our minds. But if music can have such profound effects on our neurochemistry, could there also be downsides? Like, could certain types of music have negative effects on the brain?
So we were talking about the potential downsides of music's influence on our brains. It's a fascinating area and one that deserves careful consideration.
Yeah, I mean, if music can have such a powerful impact on our neurochemistry, it stands to reason that there could be negative consequences as well, right? Like, could certain types of music be detrimental to brain health?
Well, it's complex. There's not a simple answer. Some research suggests a correlation between certain types of music and aggression or negative mood. But it's hard to isolate music as the sole cause, you know? There's so many other factors at play.
Right, like social context, individual preferences, even cultural background. It's not like you can just say this type of music is bad for you and apply that universally.
Exactly. But there's definitely room for more research here. For example, what about prolonged exposure to extremely loud music? We know that can damage hearing, but could it have other, more subtle effects on the brain?
That's a good point. And what about the lyrical content? Could exposure to violent or negative lyrics have a negative impact, especially on developing brains?
Possibly. I mean, we know that language can shape our thoughts and behaviors, so it's not unreasonable to think the musical lyrics could have a similar effect, even subconsciously.
It's a bit like the debate around violent video games, right? Does exposure desensitize us to violence or even encourage aggressive behavior? It's a tricky area to study.
It is. And with music, it's even more complicated because it's so intertwined with our emotions and identities. It's not just a passive form of entertainment. It's a deeply personal experience.
Absolutely. So while there might be some potential downsides to consider, it's important to remember that music also has incredible therapeutic potential. We've talked about how it can be used to treat various conditions, from Parkinson's to depression.
Right. And, you know, even beyond formal music therapy, music can be a powerful tool for self-care and emotional regulation. Just listening to a favorite song can sometimes lift our spirits or help us process difficult emotions.
It's like a universal language that can tap into parts of our brains that words sometimes can't reach. and that's pretty amazing. So perhaps instead of focusing solely on potential negative effects, we should also explore how to harness the power of music for good.
So we've been discussing the fascinating intersection of music therapy and neuroscience. It's really remarkable how much research is being done in this area, showing the profound impact music can have on the brain.
Yeah, it's truly mind-blowing. I mean, we've touched on everything from stroke rehabilitation to treating disorders of consciousness, and the evidence is mounting that music can be a powerful therapeutic tool.
Absolutely. And what's particularly exciting is the growing number of studies that combine music therapy with neuroimaging techniques like fMRI and EEG. It's like we're finally starting to peek under the hood and see what's actually happening in the brain when people engage with music.
Right, and that's leading to some really interesting insights, like the research on melodic intonation therapy for aphasia, showing how it can prime sensory motor and premotor cortices for articulation. That's pretty remarkable stuff.
It is, and the studies on music and dementia are equally compelling, showing how musical memory can be preserved even in advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease. It really speaks to the power of music to tap into deep-seated neural pathways.
Yeah. And you know, it's not just about treating illness. We've also talked about how music can enhance cognitive function in healthy individuals, like improving memory and attention. It almost seems like music can be a form of brain training.
It's a fascinating area, but I do think it's important to acknowledge the limitations of neuroscience research in this field. As we discussed, it can be challenging to isolate the specific effects of music, given the complex interplay of emotional, social, and cultural factors.
That's a good point. And you know, many of the current neuroscience methods, like fMRI, require participants to be in a very controlled artificial environment that can make it difficult to generalize the findings to real-world music therapy settings.
Exactly. And we also need to be mindful of the ethical considerations, especially when working with vulnerable populations like individuals with disorders of consciousness or ASD.
Right. But despite these challenges, I'm incredibly optimistic about the future of music therapy and neuroscience research. As technology advances, we'll have even more sophisticated tools to explore the complex interplay between music and the brain.
I agree. And, you know, it's not just about the technology, it's also about fostering collaboration between music therapists and neuroscientists. By working together, we can ask more nuanced questions and develop more effective therapeutic interventions.
Absolutely. And ultimately, that's what it's all about, using this knowledge to improve people's lives, whether it's helping someone recover from a stroke, manage their anxiety, or simply connect with themselves and others on a deeper level. Music has the potential to be a truly transformative force.